So I'm going to talk about the GLAST Large Area Telescope. We call it the LAT, which is a large area telescope. So this is the GLAST, which is the Gamma Ray Large Area Space Telescope, Large Area Telescope. And this has to do with the way NASA names things, but I won't go into it. This is sort of an outline. I'll spend some time on just a general introduction involving sort of the character of the mission, the collaboration, the instrument, and then give an overview of the science capabilities, where I'll spend most of the time, and then I'll talk a little bit about the schedule. So the mission is actually more complex than just the Large Area Telescope. That's why we had to name it. The mission started with just being the Large Area Telescope, and we named it GLAST a long time ago. But when NASA, when it became an official NASA mission and the AO came out, the community felt, the peer review community felt that there should be an additional small instrument to supplement the GLAST science, and there was a competition for that instrument, and it is now the Gamma Ray Burst Monitor, which is led by Marshall Space Flight Center, is going to provide, I think, exciting. I have this time; I can't talk too fast. Exciting. Additional information is taking us from 20 kV to 20 MeV on gamma ray bursts, and then GLAST should actually, this is higher, they overlap us, it goes up to about 30, and this goes from 20 to 300. So we have a range which is unprecedented for gamma ray bursts in one instrument, and they also have a all sky coverage which actually exceeds ours in terms of the spectroscopy and timing. They will get an initial first, from many bursts, they will see them and get a positional information that they will transmit to the LAT, and we can take advantage of that as we see fit. So I don't want to go into this too much, but a NASA mission, it's complicated, particularly since we have our receiving station in Equatorial Africa in Malindi. It's an Italian station. They are contributing that to get the data down. So the data path is somewhat tortuous. It comes from Malindi, it goes to Italy, then it comes over to the States and eventually winds up in mission operations and then comes to our science support centers, the LAT, and here operations and the gamma ray burst operations, and quickly then when the mission's in steady state after the first year, within a very short time goes to the science support centers out on the web and is available for general use. There will be a user's sort of guest observer program. The guest observer program right now is probably going to be idea driven in that, the way NASA folks are supported through this guest observer program through their science, and so they will submit proposals. They will be judged on the scientific merit. They will get support, but they won't have the data per se to their own use exclusively. Since it's a large area instrument, it collects data from the entire sky all the time, but they will have their idea will be preserved. It will be some sort of a gentleman's agreement that people will not work on that particular use of the data. Let's say we had some use of the data which involved a very general program looking at, let's say, a catalog or something of that sort, and then a person wanted to look at a few sources, a guest observer wanted to look at a few sources and actually do some science with those sources. He proposed to do that science with a few sources. He'd have access to that data for that purpose, and other people would agree that they would not work on that. But the entire proprietary period is 3 months for the data, so generally it isn't that much to begin with. So to first order, all the data is out there for people to work on as they will. Just download it from the web. There's sort of an overview of our collaboration. We have 200 collaborators approximately that are involved in one way or another with the instrument. There's a relatively smaller number of people, I would say, on the order of half of those that are actually building constructing the instrument, and then there's also, you know, people that are doing science preparations and other kinds of activities that make up the rest. There, here is sort of a, the silicon tower tracker here sort of shows that. I'll talk 12 layers of silicon strip detectors shown here. The gamma ray converts in tungsten conversion plates, either 3% or 18% at the back, and then an E plus E minus pair is made, and then that pair is captured in the cesium calorimeter, which is about 8.4 radiation lengths. The total radiation lengths here is about 10 in the whole system. And with the multi-layers, we can get a pretty good estimate of very high energy particles, because we sample longitudinal shower, and we also have good pattern recognition to get rid of backgrounds. There's a segmented ACD device here. There's the grid and thermal radiators, and sort of the flags are indicating participation, the sort of lead countries in developing these particular aspects. The data acquisition of rather complex. We'll have a computer farm on board processing data as it comes off, and we have to get a rather large reduction in the trigger rate, which is overwhelmingly cosmic rays, before we ship things down to the ground. Here are sort of the performance overview. So the single photon angular resolution is dominated by multiple scattering at low energy, 3.5 degrees, but rapidly goes up, goes down as you go up in energy. It's 0.15 degrees, and we can do arc minute kind of localizations with reasonably bright sources with GLAST, which is a dramatic improvement, as I'll show, over EGRIT. Has about 40 times EGRIT sensitivity, where EGRIT had sensitivity. Of course, it has sensitivity where EGRIT had none, because it goes to much higher energy. Has a large effective area. Currently, this is about 10,000 square centimeters, but the science requirements say that document indicates it has to be greater than 8,000. We have wide energy range, up to 300. Actually, we could probably see sources at a TeV. We know we can see the crab at a TeV. We'll see what else we might be able to see. We have a wide field of view and very low dead time and good energy resolution. Matter of fact, there is a requirement of 6% for photons entering at 50 degrees or greater. So this is sort of the project organization. These are sort of the people that are building, an overview of the people that are actually building the instrument. It doesn't speak much about the science organization, the science working group, other elements of the science organization and the collaboration. This emphasizes the people that are actually building the instrument. And the PI is Peter Michelson from Stanford University. This is the project office, which is all of us are co-located at Slack. I'm actually the integrate and test manager for the instrument. And then this shows the various subsystems, tracker, CAL, ACD. This is the instrument operations center, science software, and this is completed already, the balloon flight, and sort of shows lead institutions involved in those. We have very strong collaboration from non-US sources. There's a big Italian contribution, a large French contribution, a large Japanese contribution. There is also a reasonable contribution from Sweden for the cesium iodide logs, and there's a small German there's one or two collaborators from Germany that have been consistently involved for a long time. Now, why do we need a satellite just to start at the beginning? Why not do this from the ground? You see, certainly there's a mixed bag. It's actually similar to CMB in a certain way, except the energy is defining why you need to be in space versus on the ground. get to high enough energy, you can do it from the ground, and that has been done. Whipple is an example. HESS is another example of devices that can do this kind of science from the ground. When you're above on the order of historically 100 to 200 GeV, people are trying to push that threshold down to 50 or so GeV. But for lower energy gammas, it's just the backgrounds start becoming overwhelming because of the interactions and how you have to detect it from the ground. And why use gamma rays? Well, basically, the universe is essentially transparent to gamma rays in the range of glass below 20 GeV or so. When you get above 20 GeV, there's questions of the EBL and how strongly that's going to absorb the gamma rays. But with gamma rays below 20 or so, as far as we know, you can go out to Z's like 700 before you start seeing effects from ionization, which might cause absorption effects. They go in straight lines, which is important, so you don't have to worry about magnetic fields. And also another point of high energy gamma rays is that they're essentially non-thermal in their character, and hence they can probe the universe in regions that are far from equilibrium, and these are responsible for the most violent energy processes in nature. And from my particular interests, what is the source of energy for nature's largest accelerators? There's limits on large extra dimensions that one can place. There's also searches for dark matter. Now here's sort of an overview of GLASS capabilities. This is a 30 grit source catalog. AGN is our bread and butter, as I'll show you. There's pulsars, there's solar physics, there's gamma ray bursts, there are cosmic ray accelerations and looking at extended objects associated with pleurions, for example. And then EGRIT shows many possible counterparts to certain sources. They're unidentified by EGRIT because the angular resolution of EGRIT was not sufficient. And we'll be able to identify many of these sources. And then there's a search for dark matter. Now, just to show you that there is a complementarity between the low and high energy, the ground-based and the space-based, we have strong connections to the ground-based experiments. We have planned to be able to overlap with them significantly. As you see, they're down in the 50 to 100 GeV range. We plan to go up to 300, and so calibration of the ground-based instruments with our instrument will be a possibility. There's sort of, you look at the EGRIT catalog from space, which emphasizes below 10 GeV, and then you look at these sources from the ground currently emphasizing above a couple of hundred GeV, you see that there's a big disparity in sources. And one wonders if these, well, when that's going to, what energy that will stop. Presumably it's EBL which is causing that. Here's a comparison of EGRIT to GLASS, sort of the improvement, where it's coming from. There's an order of magnitude in energy. There's a factor of 6 in effective area. The field of view is a factor of 4 higher. Sensitivity is a factor of 20 higher in the range where EGRIT has sensitivity. And the localization is about a factor of 30 better, and the dead time is a factor of 100 better. And it's a large, we have a large field of view, so our operational strategy is going to be much different. Whereas EGRIT tended to point and hold their pointings for 2 weeks, let's say to take an all-sky survey, GLASS is sort of just going to sit there and slowly rock as it goes through in its orbit and just collect data through the entire sky, and I'll show you how that works in a little bit. Here, for example, is the issue of why EGRIT can't see, identify many of these sources. Here's an EGRIT 95% sort of identification regime compared to this source here. And here is what GLASS would be right there for that particular source. And here is a 5 sigma LAT source. This is our 95% confidence level sort of localization. So you see that GLASS has this dramatic improvement and its ability to localize sources, and thus we can better associate those sources with known objects at different wavelengths. The science capability in terms of the transient sensitivity in GLAST is really designed for the transient sky, because that's what's going on in this energy range a lot of the time, and certainly in the in the point sources, not in the back in the diffuse background. But so here is GLAST after 100 seconds, and here it's compared to typical egret fluxes. And so in 100 seconds, you know, you're sort of down to this level. In one orbit, you're already seeing the lowest 5 sigma detection from egret. And in one day, you're seeing the weakest 5 sigma egret source. So in one day, we sort of have the egret sensitivity over the entire sky. We also will, I think, do quite well on gamma ray bursts. As I indicated, I don't have enough time really to go into this, but with the gamma ray burst monitor augmenting the GLAST science, I think we will do a very good job in expanding our knowledge of gamma ray bursts. The bread and butter, as I mentioned, is the AGN. Supermassive black holes presumably drive them. They change characteristically of black hole accretion on levels of very short time, fractions of a day, that have been seen in egret. And sort of understanding this process and expanding the catalog of these by a lot, as I'll show, is one of the main goals, sort of the bread and butter of the experiment. Or I think as I've shown. The diffuse background emission is very important for a lot of fundamental science. The WIMP science will come out of that, certainly the extra large, large extra dimension limits will come out of understanding these kinds of sources. There's the galactic, and then there's the extragalactic, and then there's also sort of emission coming from, let's say, other galaxies, like Draco, which is a dwarf galaxy which is close by, which I'll go into more detail. And there is a, egret spent a lot of time sort of trying to model this with diffuse models, and including cosmic ray nucleon interactions, Bremsstrahlung inverse Compton interactions, and used surveys of the gas to calculate in Monte Carlo the interaction of cosmic rays, assuming uniform distribution in the galaxy, and then compared with their observations, and they got generally good agreement, but there are details which obviously say, if you take it literally, it's not all cosmic rays. So this is actually the extragalactic diffuse background from a number of experiments, including egret. This is GLAST shown here, what we will contribute. And by pulling out, with our better ability to localize sources, we should be able to pull out a lot of the AGN that are projected to be there. We, given, you know, sort of log n, log s projections from egret results and other sources, we would expect to see thousands of AGN actually in GLAST. Egret saw on the order of a couple of hundred. Now, this is very fundamental in a lot of the science, understanding this particular issue. For example, this is a paper about a year ago, and there's been a few papers since talking about supernova contributions in the context of Kaluza-Klein graviton production. It turns out that production leads to the production of photons in the GLAST regime. And you can then look at the extragalactic background, see its level, and from that you can set a limit in the context of that theory on the number of on the size of extra dimensions, and actually EGRIT now has the best estimate, the most stringent limits on the size of extra dimensions comes from EGRIT, based upon this type of analysis. These people here have, this is I think one of the first papers they've published a number since, looking at different aspects of the same kind of thing. We'll certainly do that, and I don't know how exactly you would see a real signal. You'd have to separate out a certain spectral signature to prove that there was a signal there, but we certainly would improve the limits by a significant amount. Then there's the question of the dark matter, and we are sort of interested in this picture. GLAST would focus on this area here, this branch, and neutrinos in particular. These would come from the center of our galaxy, and the structure of our center of our galaxy is very important in trying to understand the dark matter halo. And this question of whether there's a black hole in the center of the galaxy and how that would, influence the character of the halo. Here is some work that has been done in the infrared on the center of the galaxy recently. Let's see, where are you? There you are. And so these are actually, these are stars at the center of our galaxy in the infrared, and it shows their motion taken over, a few years. And so you see this incredible motion, which where you can measure not only the velocity distributions, but you can measure the accelerations of these objects and get a very good handle that way on what's at the center. And what you find is from this stellar radial and proper motion, there's a dark mass of about 2.6 times 10 to the 6th solar masses, and it's within a light week of the compact radio source at the center of the galaxy. Now, with this, and they also have other estimates for density. So its density is 2.2 times 10 to the 12th solar masses per cubic parsec or greater, and it's really hard to understand this except in the context of a black hole, whatever a black hole is. So it seems to me, I was personally pretty hard to convince, but this is very convincing evidence that there really is something like a black hole at the center of the galaxy, and so any halo model and dark matter halo model has to take that into account seriously. I don't think you can really get out of that. Well, EGRIT sees an excess from the galactic center, and this is published paper. I think it's an excellent piece of work. I know the people. This is one of our German collaborators on GLAST as well, and that information, that data, can be taken and put in the context of a WIMP fit. And our Italian collaborators have actually, I'm going to do this first. There's also other evidence, which is not as strong, from Dixon et al., about excess photons coming sort of a halo unaccounted for. And it shows you these, it sort of removes all of the photons that are supposedly there from the diffuse background, and then is left with these pockets. And then there's sort of this general glow, but certainly here, a statistically significant remnant when you subtract the classic cosmic grays. Now, what this is actually is, again, disputed. I think GLAST will really make a much more sensitive job of this, and we know for sure that it's not a background, for example, residual proton background or something of that sort that's causing. And so neutrino annihilations are the sort of a primary candidate. It can go to gamma-gamma or it can go to z-gamma for lines, but it also can just, they annihilate and a third of the energy comes out as photons. And here is sort of the way we calculated for our proposal what was going on. You use sort of the new theories that showed a boost in this production, which made it much more interesting, taking into account the higher order diagrams as compared to the lowest order, which is shown here. And this was done some time ago. And then it would take our resolution. This is an optimistic resolution. This is our goal, actually, in the proposal. And then you use what's now probably, from the particle physics point of view, a conservative point of view, which is Navarro, Frank, and White, which is sort of a 1 over R dependence of the halo. And then you get these kinds of limits from glass. This is MSSM with other constraints coming from other experiments, sort of the phase space that's left. This is 95% confidence upper limit, so we really would exclude some significant part of this phase space. And then in the case of pure Higgs-Zeno, for example, there are various other possibilities, but they involve non-thermal production. This is all thermal WIMP production. If you have non-thermal production, you can produce these other kinds of states. Of course, you get much higher rates. Now, looking at the center of the galaxy, but using the Moore halo, which is more optimistic from the point of view of producing WIMPs. Our Italian collaborators made this fit, and you see you get a very significant signal if you took this seriously in terms of the background subtraction and such. There's actually it's not a statistical problem, it's a systematic problem, and we don't believe that this is a detection of WIMPs. But I think GLAST, again, can make a much, much more of a detailed examination of various aspects and either show that this is might be really WIMPs or not. We just take this as a limit and then define sort of the range that would be excluded in supersymmetric space by GLAST looking at the center of the galaxy. There's also a new paper out by Tyler. Now, this uses cis, which is gamma equals 2, which seems extremely optimistic. And I've talked to a number of people. It doesn't seem exactly justified. But in this paper, they actually try to justify that for Draco. And Draco has the mass of a dwarf galaxy in the starlight of a globular cluster, so it's highly dominated by dark matter. It does not have a black hole in the center, and so they make an argument that it should have developed, in a very undisturbed way in terms of the dark matter halo. And so you see here that GLAST would, between GLAST and the ground-based experiments, we totally essentially exclude MSSM. EGRIT already cuts in somewhat strongly into the MSSM regime. But this is very highly dependent on the character of that halo. And so here's the Moore halo here, for example, and doesn't cut any ice at all. So the character, that's for Draco. So the character of the halo obviously is very important in determining what limits we're able to set. But if we actually were to see something, it might help, inversely tell us what the character of the halo is. And that could be very interesting for astrophysics. Schedule. Oh. Yeah, wish it was that fast. Well, we just passed a major review at SLAC, this was a DOE review. On August 1st, we have many reviews from NASA and the DOE. Somehow they didn't manage to combine their reviews. And it shows here that we're now in the final design and engineering model phase. We have our CDR scheduled for April 30th of next year, and then we go into full construction. And then we go into INT, integrate and test phase here. We have built in a significant amount of schedule float at the end, a delivery to the vendor that goes on for a year. to integrate with the spacecraft and take it down to the Cape, where it'll be launched on a Delta II from Cape Kennedy. And then we start operations. Scheduled launch is 2006, September. And we expect that the design is 5 years. The goal is 10 years of operation. EGRID actually with gas spark chambers operated for 9 years. So this technology has no consumables, and so we hope, you know, if everything goes well, we can certainly last 10 years. Thank you. No, all it was the cusp. They also talk about clumps in there, but the only differences I showed were gamma going from, you know, 2 down to, you know, 1.5 or so.
Which is the cusp.
Mm-hmm. As far as EGRID goes, like if you have one over R squared at the center, which is rather extreme, then you get bounce. With this 1 over R with a 1.9, no bounce.
It makes a big difference. Yes?
Could you say something about the speed with which gamma ray bursts will be transmitted to the ground and how we'll know the localization?
Well, BATSE has this network, and I think that this gamma ray burst monitor will be very similar to BATSE in terms of the time frame that it comes down. So it will sort of replace BATSE from that point of view. It's not quite as large as BATSE, but it should have reasonable sensitivity. I don't have a specification exactly now. A science working group has defined a rather short time, and we have to make sure that we get into that. But bursts that we see, all transient phenomena that GLASS sees, are as quickly as possible put out in the public domain. And I would expect that since we have a more difficult time in terms of the data analysis and such, it would take somewhat longer, but not a lot.
But was there some limitation about the ground station and so on?
That would go through TDRS. So that would be a TDRS. So if we had rapid reporting, it would not go through the ground station. So for transient response events, we get it down in a similar speed as BATSE did. That's.
And basically, you show these constraints on the SUSE parameters.
Can I convince people to talk a little louder? So I'm sure in the back they can't hear you.
Maybe you should stand up.
You show these constraints on the SUSE parameters from the gamma ray line?
No, that was just from the kind of fit. The two constraints, kinds of things I showed. The gamma ray lines was that black line from our proposal on that green background. It showed how we constrained. That was the first plot I showed. That involved the Navarro-Franklin-White, more conservative kind of black halo, dark matter halo. Then there was the limit from the EGRIT result with the Moore halo, and that was the much more colorful plot, which had a sort of a red banana showing the limits that we got, and that was from the continuum, the case. So since our proposal, I think we made a lot of progress on the continuum decays. Our proposal tended to focus on the lines.
Okay, well,